May take madness to cure the mad. Just bring him here, would you? We'll see if my notion works.
Tedric looked rather doubtful, but rode off and returned less than an hour later with a warmly wrapped toddler. The child was colicky and crying to himself.
"Now get her out of the house, I don't care how,"
she told Tedric wearily, taking the baby from him and soothing it into quiet.
"But make sure that she leaves that doll behind."
Tedric coaxed the Weather Witch to follow him out with a bit of sweet, after persuading her to leave her infant behind in the cradle by the smoky fire. Talia slipped in when her back was turned. Seconds after that, a baby's wail penetrated the walls of the cottage, and the madwoman started as if she'd been struck. It was the most incredible transformation Chris had ever seen. The half-crazed, wild animal look left her eyes, and sense and intelligence flooded back in. In a few seconds, she made the transition from thing to human.
Chethre,
she faltered. The baby cried again, louder this time.
Chethre,
she cried in answer, and ran through the door. In the cradle was the child Tedric had brought, perhaps something under a year old, crying lustily. She scooped the child up and held it to her breast, holding it as if it were her own soul given back to her, laughing and weeping at the same time. No sooner did her hands touch the child when the last and perhaps strangest thing of all happened. It stopped crying immediately and began cooing back at the woman. Talia was not even watching, just sagging against the lintel, rubbing her temples. The other two could only watch the transformation in bemusement. At last the woman took her attention from the baby she held and focused on Talia. She moved toward her hesitantly and halted when she was a few steps away.
"Harold," she said with absolute certainty, "you did this. You brought me my baby back. He was dead, but you found him again for me."
Talia looked up at that, eyes like darker shadows on her face, and shook her head in denial.
"Not I, my lady. If anyone brought him back, it was you. And it was you who showed me where to find him."
The woman reached out to touch Talia's cheek. Chris made as if to interfere, but Talia motioned him away, signaling him that she was in no danger.
"You will reclaim what was yours,"
the Weather Witch said tonelessly, her eyes focused on something none of them could see.
"And no one will ever shake it from you again. You will find your heart's desire, but not until you have seen the heavens. The heavens will call you, but duty and love will bar you from them. Love will challenge death to reclaim you. Your greatest joy will be preceded by your greatest sorrow, and your fulfillment will not be unshadowed by grief." "There is no joy that has not tasted first of grief," Talia quoted softly, as if to herself, so softly that Chris could barely hear the words.
The woman's eyes refocused.
"Did I say something? Did I see something?"
she asked, confusion evident in her eyes.
"Was it the answer you were looking for?"
"It was answer enough,"
Talia replied with a smile.
"But haven't you more important things to think of?"
"My Chethre, my little love,"
she exclaimed, holding the child closely, her eyes bright with tears.
"There's so much I have to do to make it up to you. Oh, Harold, how can I ever thank you enough?"
"By loving and caring for Chethre as much as you do now, and not worrying what others may say about it,"
Talia told her, motioning to the other two to leave and following them quickly.
"Bright heavens!"
Tedric exclaimed a little uneasily when they were out of earshot of the cottage.
"That was like old tales of witchcraft and curse-lifting. What kind of strange magic did you work back there?"
"To tell you the truth, I'm not very sure myself," Talia said, rubbing tired eyes with the back of her hand. "When I touched her this morning, I seemed to see a kind of court, tie, something like that. Anyway, it was binding her to something, and I seemed to see that page in the report about the gypsies. I know outlanders aren't terribly welcome here, so I took a chance that the survivor wouldn't find a new home very easily. You confirmed what I guessed, Tedric, and it just seemed to me that what she needed was a second chance to make everything right. Am I making sense?
More sense than I hoped for. It's hardly possible that he could be hers. Is it?
Chris asked hesitantly. Chris, I'm no priest. How on earth can I answer that? All I can tell you is what I saw and felt. The little one is about the same age as hers would have been, and they certainly seem to recognize each other, if only as two lost ones needing love. I won't hazard a guess after that.
This is a terribly callous thing to ask, I know,
Tedric said, looking a good bit less anxious now that the magic was explained away as rational common sense.
But she won't lose her powers now that her mind is back, will she?
Set your fears at rest. I think you and the people of Berry Bay can count on their weather witch yet, Talia replied. Speaking from personal experience, I can tell you that such gifts rarely lie back down to rest once you've roused them. Look at what she said to me.
Love will challenge death to reclaim you, Chris quoted. Strange and rather ambiguous, it seems to me. Prophecy has a habit of being ambiguous,
Tedric said wryly.
It's fortunate that she's able to be more exact when it comes to giving us weather warnings. Come now, you and Roland are tired and hungry, Talia, both of you. You deserve a good meal and a good night's rest before you take the road again.
In prophecy to the contrary, my heart's desire at the moment is one of your venison pies, followed by a convivial quiet evening and a good sleep in your feather bed. And I hardly think I need to seek out the havens to find that. Talia laughed tiredly, linking arms with Tedric and Chris, while Roland followed behind. Well, she had weathered this one. Now all she had to do was continue to survive. Chapter 11
Well, little bird, Chris said lazily, it's almost midsummer. You're halfway done. Evaluation, please.
Talia picked idly at the grass beside her.
Is this serious or facetious?
Quite serious.
The sun approached zenith, and a warm spot created when the white gold rays found a gap in the leaves of the tree overhead was planted just on Talia's right shoulder blade. Insects droned in the long grass. Occasionally, a bird called, sleepily. They were at the station at the bottom of their sector, where they had first entered, back last autumn. Today, or the next day, a courier herald would make a rendezvous with them, bringing them the latest laws and news. Until then, their time was their own. They had been spending it in unaccustomed leisure. She thought, long and hard, while Chris chewed on a grass stem, lying on his back in the shade, eyes narrowed to slits.
"It's been horrid,"
she said finally, lying back and pillowing her head on her arm. "I wish these past 9 months had never happened. It's been awful, especially when we first get into a town and they've heard about me, but..."
"Hmm?"
he prompted, when the silence had gone on too long.
"But what if this, my gift, going rogue, had happened at court? It would have been worse."
"You would have been able to get help there," he pointed out. "Better than you've gotten from me."
"Only after I'd wrecked something. Gods, I hate to think. Letting loose that storm in a packed court."
She shuddered. "At least I've got projection under control consciously now, rather than instinctively. Even if my shields aren't completely back."
"Still having shield problems?"
"You know so. You've seen me in crowds. There are times when I hate you for keeping me out here, but then I realize that I can't go back until I have my shields back. And we can't let anyone know about this mess until it's fixed, not even heralds."
"So, you figured that out for yourself?"
"It didn't take much. If people knew that the rumors were at least partially true, they'd believe the rest of it. I've watched you play in protector for me every time we meet another herald. And there's something else. I can't go back until I figure something out."
"What?"
"Not just the how of my gift, but the why and the when. It's obsessing me. Because those rumors about manipulation come so close to the truth, I have used my gift to evaluate counselors, and I have acted on that information. When does it start becoming manipulation?"
"I don't know."
"Now I'm more than half afraid to use the gift."
"Oh, hell."
He flopped over onto his side, hair blowing into his eyes.
Now that bothers me. Hellfire, none of this would have happened to you if I'd just kept my mouth shut.
And it might well have happened at a worse time.
And might not have.
Those blue eyes bored into hers.
What's gone wrong is as much my fault as yours.
She had no answer for him.
Well, the situation went wrong, but I think we're turning it around,
he said at last. I hope so. I think so.
Well, you're handling everything else fine.
There was an uneasiness under his words. She was sensitive enough now to tell that it had something to do with her personally, not her as a herald.
Oh, gods.
She did her best to hide her dismay. She had done her level best to keep their relationship on a friend-lover basis and not let her gift manipulate him into infatuation, or worse. Most of the time, she thought she'd succeeded. But then came the times like these, the times when he looked at her with a shadowed expression. She knew now that she didn't want anything more from him, for as her need of him grew less, her feelings had mellowed into something very like what she shared with Skiff. But what of him?
I wonder what Dirk's up to, he said out of the blue. He's sector riding this term, too.
If he has any sense, being glad he's not having to eat your cooking.
She threw a handful of grass at him. He grinned back.
Tell me something. Why do you keep calling me Little Bird?
Good question. It's Dirk's name for you. You remind him of a woodlark.
What's a woodlark? She asked curiously. I've never seen one.
You normally don't see them, you only hear them. Woodlarks are very shy, and you have to know exactly what you're looking for when you're trying to spot one. They're very small, brown, and blend almost perfectly with the bushes. For all that they're not very striking, they're remarkably pretty in their own quiet way. But he wasn't thinking about that when he named you. Woodlarks have the most beautiful voices in the forest.
Oh, she said, surprised by the compliment and not knowing quite how to respond.
I can even tell you when he started using it. It was just after you'd fainted, and he'd picked you up to carry you to your room. Bright Havens, said he, she weighs no more than a little bird. Then the night of the celebration when we all sang together, I caught him staring at you when you were watching the dancers and muttering under his breath, a woodlark, she's a shy little woodlark. Then he saw me watching him and glared for a minute and said, "Well, she is." Not wanting to get my eyes blackened, I agreed. I would have agreed anyway. I always do when he's right.
"You two," she said, "are crazy."
"No, m'lady, we're heralds. It's close, but not quite to the point of actual craziness."
"That makes me crazy, too."
"You said it," he pointed out. "I didn't."
Before she could think of a suitable reply, they heard a hail from the path that led to their station and scrambled to their feet. It was their courier, and their courier was Skiff.
"Well, a day," he said, dismounting as they approached him. "You two certainly look ale and elfy. Very much so for a pair who was supposed to have come near perishing in that midwinter blizzard. Dirk was damn worried when I talked to him. If you're going to be seeing him sometime soon, or can find a bard to pass the message, you can tell him that we're both fine, and the worst we suffered was the loss of Talia's harp case."
Chris said with a laugh.
"If! Bright Havens! I haven't got any choice. I've been flat ordered to find him when I'm done with briefing you, on pain of unspecified torture. You'd have thought from the way he was acting that neither of you had the mother wit to save yourselves from a wetting, much less a blizzard."
Chris gave Talia another odd, sidelong glance.
"You'd best bring your companion and whatever you've brought for us on up to the way station," she said. "It's going to take you a while to pass everything to us, and to make sure we've got it right."
"A while? Oh, modest Talia! With you, I've got no fear that it'll take long."
Skiff grinned.
"I know quite well that you can memorize faster than I can, and Chris was my far-seeing teacher, so I know he's just as quick. I'll turn Simri loose and let her kick her heels up a little. I can lead the pack mule afoot."
"We'll take a tack for you," Chris offered. "No use in you carrying it when we're unburdened."
Skiff accepted the offer gladly, and they strolled up the path toward the station together. Chris, with the saddle and blanket balanced over one shoulder, Talia with the rest of the tack, Skiff with the saddlebags.
I've brought you two quite a load," he told them as they approached the station, "both material and news. Hope you're ready."
"More than ready," Talia told him. "I'm getting pretty tired of telling the same old tales."
"Don't I just know. Well, I've got plenty of news, personal and public, and more than you may guess. Do you want your news first or your packs?"
"Both," Chris said with the charming smile of a child. "You can tell us the personal news while we gloat over our goodies."
"Why not?" Skiff chuckled. "I'll start with the Collegium and work my way outward."
The first bit of news was that Gaetha and Miro had surprised nearly everyone by suddenly deciding to wed. They had had themselves hand-fasted just before Skiff had left and were to be wedded in the fall. Chris's jaw sagged over that piece of news, but Talia, recalling things she'd seen over holidays while still a student, nodded without much surprise. Karen had broken her hip during the past winter. She'd slipped and taken a bad fall trying to rescue a companion foal from beneath a downed tree. The foal was frightened silly, but otherwise emerged from the ordeal unscathed. The same, obviously, could not be said for poor Karen. Cheryl had taken on Karen's duties as riding instructor as well as her own scheduled classes. When Karen's bones were healed, she decided that it was getting to be time to think about training a successor anyway, so they were currently sharing the classes. Albrecht had at last retired from teaching all but the most advanced students. To no one's surprise, he had appointed Jerry to take his place. Companions had chosen 20 youngsters this spring, the largest number yet. For the first time in years, the Collegium was completely full. No one knew whether there should be rejoicing or apprehension over this sudden influx of chosen. The last time that the Collegium had been full had been in Selene's father's time. There had been the Tedral Wars with Carsey on the eastern border shortly thereafter, and every one of the students had been needed to replace those heralds that had sought the havens when it was over. Elspeth was doing unexpectedly well, and Talia rejoiced to hear it. Elkarth had taken her heavy schedule and lightened it by a considerable amount, and she had responded by working like a fiend incarnate on those classes that were left. She seemed determined to prove that she was not ungrateful for the respite, and that she did not intend to shirk her remaining responsibilities. There was little news of the court, but none of that was good. The rumor mills had been churning away, mostly working on the grist of Elspeth and the absent Talia. About half of it was elaboration on the rumors they already knew. The rest concerned Elspeth's supposed unfitness for the crown, that she was too pliant, too much of a hoyden, not bright enough, and too dependent on the heralds in general and Talia in particular to make all her decisions for her. Chris noted without comment the brief shadow of pain that veiled her face.
"But I've told anybody who's bothered to bring up the subject that whoever started these tales had owls in his skull. Elspeth's nothing but a normal tomboy like Jerry, and they were perfectly willing to consider Jerry's heir. And I told them nobody who knows you would even consider the idea that you might be misusing your gift. So, that's that. All right, it's your turn,"
Skiff ordered.
"You two have to tell me the old tale of your blizzard. I've been strictly charged by Off the Circle to bring back every detail. If you leave one thing out, I'm not entirely certain of my safety when I get back."
Chris told most of it, from the plague at Waymeet to the arrival of Tedric, leaving out the disintegration of Talia's control.
"Sounds grim," Skiff said when they'd finished. "I'm surprised you didn't tear each other's throats out, from boredom if nothing else. Of course you were too busy digging out to have time to be bored."
Chris inhaled his wine and nearly choked to death trying to keep from laughing. Talia covered her blushes by pounding his back, then took over the conversation with a stern glance in his direction that almost sent him into another fit. "It was a good thing we had the harp with us," she said, firmly restraining the urge to set both her hands around his throat and strangle him. "Music did a lot to keep us going. And we discovered something really strange, Skiff. Did you know that those stories the Northerners kept telling us about how Churras sing are true?"
"You've been on circuit too long,"
he replied with a disbelieving grin.
"She's telling the truth, Skiff," Chris asserted. "Churras do sing. Well, hum is more like it. They do it intentionally, though, and I've heard worse harmonics coming from human throats. Can you prove this? Otherwise, I'm going to have a hard time convincing anyone else, much less myself." Are you planning on spending the night with us, so long as I'm not in the way?
You can stay if you clean up dinner, Talia teased. We'll cook for you, but you'd better do your share of the work.
Anything is better than having to eat my own cooking,
Skiff replied with a hearty sigh.
When I was interning, Dirk absolutely refused to let me cook anything after the first two meals I ruined. I don't blame him. I'm the only person I know that can boil an egg for an hour and have it turn out half-scorched and half-raw. Then you'll get your demonstration after dinner.
When they had finished their evening meal, Talia called the Churras up from the lake to the way station and gave the demonstration Skiff had demanded. As the first notes rose from the pack beast's long throats, Skiff's eyes widened in disbelief. A quick look around, however, soon proved to him that there was no trickery involved. After the first two songs, he relaxed and admitted that he found the weird harmonics quite pleasant, if at first startling. When they tired of singing, they began trading road tales. Skiff had by far the largest stock of funny stories, since his assignment as courier put him in contact with a wide variety of situations. In one case, he'd had to rescue his contactee at the meeting point from an amorous and overly enthusiastic cow. But in the midst of what Skiff had thought was one of his more amusing anecdotes, Talia suddenly excused herself and walked out into the night with some haste.
"Did I say something wrong?"
Skiff said, bewildered, since she had been giving every evidence of enjoying the story until then.
"What's the matter with her?" "I have no more idea than you,"
Chris started to say. Then he thought of something.
"Just wait a moment."
He closed his eyes and mind-called to Tantris. The answer he got made him half-smile, although he spared a flash of pity for Talia.
"She'll be back in a little while," he told the puzzled Skiff, "when she's less, shall we say, uncomfortable."
Skiff was annoyed.
"Just what is that supposed to mean?"
"Skiff, your Simri's a mare."
"That was fairly obvious."
"Roland's a stallion. A stallion that hasn't been near a companion mare for several months. Talia's gift, in case you've forgotten, is empathy, and unlike most of us, she tells me that Roland is always with her, in the back of her head, as she calls it."
"What?"
Skiff was bewildered. Then realization dawned.
"Oh-ho, I forgot a little experiment we did. You can't shield out your companion with a bond that tight, can you?"
"That's it. Not on that level, you can't.
And with her gift thrown in, it's even more overpowering. As I recall, you can barely mind-speak, right? So you're protected from Simri's sporting. Needless to say, the same is not true for Talia."
Skiff's chuckle was just a touch heartless.
"Too bad your Tantris isn't a mare."
"I've had that thought a time or two myself," Chris admitted, joining the chuckle. Skiff sobered abruptly.
"Look, Chris, I know it's none of my business, but are you and Talia, you know..."
"Damned right it's none of your business," Chris said calmly. He'd been expecting the question, assuming that Skiff was only waiting to get him alone. "So, why are you asking?"
"Chris, it's part of my job to notice things, and I've noticed that while you aren't cuddled up like courting doves, you're both a lot easier with each other than I've ever seen either of you around anyone else."
Skiff paused, then remained silent.
"You were obviously planning on saying more. Go on." "I owe Dirk. I owe him my life. By all rights, he should have left us when Simri and I fell into that ravine while I was interning. He had no way of knowing we were still alive, and the trail was washing out under him with every second he stayed. But he didn't leave. He searched all through that downpour until he found us. And if he hadn't, we wouldn't be here now. He's been acting damn peculiar whenever anybody mentions Talia. He was starting to act that way when you two left, and it's gotten worse since then. Dear old, indifferent to women Dirk came close to tearing my heart out and feeding it to me when I couldn't give him any more information about you two than rumor. And I would bet my Ope of Avens that it wasn't over your welfare. So if you two are more than friends, I want to know. Maybe I can break it to him gently."
"Oh, gods," Chris said weakly. "Oh, gods.
I don't know, Skiff. I mean, I know how I feel, which is that I'm quite fond of her, and that's all. But I don't know how she feels. I'm afraid to find out. I have the suspicion that there's a lot more going on here than you've told me, Skiff replied. You want to make a full confession?
Gods.
I'd better go back a few years. Look, the reason Dirk pretends to be indifferent to women is because he was so badly hurt by one that he came within a hair of killing himself. It was that bitch, Lady Narrell. It was when we were first assigned to court. She wanted me. I wasn't having any. So she used Dirk to get at me. Don't tell me. She played the sweet innocent on him. She tried working that one on me, but I'd had warning.
I wish Dirk had. By the time I knew what was happening, it was too late. He was flopping like a stranded fish. She used him to set up a meeting between us, and at that point she handed me an ultimatum. Either I became her lapdog, or she would make Dirk's life hell for him. Unfortunately, she hadn't counted on the fact that Dirk was jealous as well as devoted. He'd stayed within earshot, and he heard the whole thing.
Good gods!
Skiff couldn't manage more than that.
Verily.
Chris closed his eyes, trying to shut out the memory of how Dirk had looked when he confronted them. It had been ghastly. Even his eyes had been dead. But what had followed had been worse. Chris had made a hasty exit, and when he'd gone, Narrell had taken Dirk to pieces. If only he'd known, he'd never have left them alone. But he was shattered. Absolutely shattered. I think it was only Aradi that kept him from throwing himself in the river that night.
Now you tell me he's acting like a man with a life bond, if you want to know the truth. He's close to being obsessed.
Talia was showing signs of the same thing. But now, I just don't know, Skiff. We started sleeping together during that blizzard. There were a lot of other complications that I can't go into, and now I don't know how she feels. But I'm mortally afraid she's gotten fixated on me.
And he was Dirk's best friend. Gods, gods, it was happening all over again.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
Skiff asked.
I'm going to break it off, that's what, before it gets too serious to be broken off. If it is a life bond, once the infatuation is nipped in the bud, she'll swing back to Dirk like a compass needle. But for Lord's sake, don't let Dirk know about any of this.
Chris rubbed his forehead, feeling almost sick with remorse.
No fear of that.
Skiff broke off what he was saying to nod significantly in the direction of the door behind Chris.
Talia entered and resumed her abandoned seat, looking much cooler and more composed.
Better? Chris asked in a sympathetic undertone.
Much, she sighed, then faced Skiff. As for you, you troublemaker, I hope you're prepared to cosset a pregnant companion in another couple of months.
Now, Talia, he chortled heartlessly, Simri's been at her games with every stallion I've rendezvoused with, and nothing like that has happened yet.
Every other stallion wasn't rolling, she said with a wry twist to her lips. Serves you right, too, for not warning me, you smug sadist. Or don't you remember your history and the extraordinary fertility of Grove stallions, particularly the companion of the Queen's Own?
Kernos's spear! I never once thought of that!
Both Chris and Talia laughed at the expression on Skiff's face.
I'd be willing to bet a full wineskin that Simri didn't think of that either. Chris added.
You just won, Skiff said, reaching behind him into his pile of belongings and throwing a leather bottle at the other herald. Oh, well, no harm without a trace of good. This will keep me off the road, but it will also keep me from having to do my own cooking. I'd better start thinking of ways to make myself useful around the court and collegium. Hope Taryn likes being courier. He's the only one free at the moment, now that the new babies are done with orientation.
He settled into his bedroll with a much bemused expression. The next day was involved in memorizing all Skiff had to impart to them. When both of them were letter-perfect in the early afternoon, Skiff packed up the few bits he had of his own personal gear and supplies and headed back the way he'd come.
"How much did you tell him?" Talia asked, watching him depart.
"Only that we've had some complications I can't go into. I had to tell him. He noticed you weren't looking too well. That's all."
He gave her yet another of those odd, sidelong glances.
Lord, poor Elspeth facing those damned rumour mongers all by herself. Gods, I need to be there, and I can't be there.
That's right, you can't. Going back now won't do you any good and might do her harm.
I know, but it doesn't stop me from wanting to.
Look at it this way. With all the rumours that are bound to start about me and you, maybe they'll forget about the others.
Oh, gods, she blushed. Have I no privacy?
Not as a herald, you don't.
They walked back to the station. Chris was brooding about something. Talia could see it in the closed expression he wore and sense it in the unhappy unease that lurked below the surface of his thoughts. It was an unease she shared. She couldn't tell exactly what was bothering him, except that it had to do with her and with Dirk. She wondered if this was a sign that her worst fear was true, that he had become far more involved with her than he'd intended. She didn't want to hurt his feelings, but damn it all, it wasn't him she wanted. If only he'd talk to her. They read their letter packets in silence. Talia's was mostly brief notes and not very many of them. But the last letter had Talia very puzzled. It was enormous, from the thickness of the packet, and yet she couldn't recognize the handwriting on the outside. She frowned at it, recalling for a moment the evil days when virulent and anonymous letters were a daily occurrence. Then she steeled herself and broke open the seal, telling herself that there was no reason why she shouldn't pitch it into the fire if it turned out to be of that ilk. To her shock and delight, it was from Dirk. The actual letter was not very long, and the phrasing was stilted and formal, yet just to know that he'd written it gave her a delightfully shivery feeling. The content was simple enough. He hoped that her close association with his partner would lead to a closer friendship among the three of them, since they all shared the common interest of music. It was in light of this common interest that he had, he said, made bold to write her. He had been assigned to the sector that contained most of the kingdom's paper mills and printing houses, and was the headquarters of the Printers and Engravers Guild. This meant that music and books that were difficult to obtain elsewhere were relatively common there. He had bought himself a great deal of new music, and had thought that Talia and Chris should have copies also. It was what he hadn't said that both excited and worried Talia. The letter was so bland that it could have reflected either polite indifference to her or been an attempt to conceal the same sort of obsession that she was feeling. Still, it was definitely odd for him to have sent the music manuscripts to Talia instead of to Chris. Chris coughed uneasily, and she looked up to meet his eyes. "What's the matter?" she asked.
"Dirk's letter," he replied. "I'm usually lucky to get a page, maybe two, but this approaches perilously the size of an epic."
"That's odd."
"That's an understatement. He rattles on about nothing like a granny gossip at a fair, and it's what he doesn't write about that's the most interesting. He dances verbally about, doing his very best to avoid the subject of my internee. That's not easy to do in a letter this size. He doesn't mention you until the very end, and then only to say that he's sent you some music that we all might like to try together sometime. It's as if he's afraid to write your name, for fear he'll give something away."
Talia swallowed a lump that had suddenly appeared in her throat. "Here's the music he sent," she replied, handing him the packet.
"Bright heavens! This must have cost him a fortune!"
Chris began sorting it into two piles, one for each of them, when something slipped out from amid the music manuscripts.
What's this?"
He picked it up. It seemed to be a slim book bound in brown leather. He leafed through it.
"This, without any doubt, is intended for you," he said soberly, handing it to her.
It was a book of ballads, among them the long version of Sun and Shadow. "How do you know he didn't buy it for himself?" she asked doubtfully. "Or you?"
"Because I happen to know he has two copies of that same book, both bound in blue, which happens to be his favorite color. One he keeps at his room, the other travels with him, and he knows I have the book. I'm the one that showed it to him. No, it's no accident that this was among the manuscripts, and it's undoubtedly the reason why he sent them to you instead of me. But, Talia, I have to talk to you. Seriously."
"Gods, here it came."
"I..."
he began, looking almost tortured.
Look, I like you a lot. I think you're one of the sweetest ladies to wear whites, and I probably should never have let you get involved with me.
What? She said, unable for a moment to comprehend what he was trying to say.
Dirk is worth 20 of me, he continued doggedly. And if you stop to think about it, you'll realize I'm right about that. You're seeing more in our relationship than exists, than can exist. I just can't give you anything more than friendship, Talia, and I can't let you ruin your life and Dirk's by letting you go on thinking, wait just a damned minute here, she interrupted him. You think that I'm infatuated with you?
He looked surprised by her reaction. Of course, he replied in an insultingly matter-of-fact tone. All the tension that had been building up inside her came to a head. She'd been putting up with his occasional air of superiority, the slight condescension he used whenever later evidence proved that some decision of his that she'd opposed turned out to be right. And there was an underlying resentment on her part at his unvoiced attitude that getting her gift under control was now largely a matter of will and not the slow rebuilding of something that had been shattered past recognition. It was that, of course, that had been the spark to set the pyre alight. She turned on him angrily, fists clenching unconsciously.
Of course! Just because every other female falls languishing at your feet, you think I've no mind of my own.
Well, he replied, taken aback, and obviously intending to try to say something to placate her.
You!
She was at a total loss for words. All this time, she'd been wasting, worrying about him, about hurting his feelings, and he had been blithely assuming that just because she'd been sleeping with him, she was obviously going to be fixated on him. Even now, he was still bewildered, perfect features blank with perfect astonishment. She pulled back her right arm and landed a perfect punch right on the end of that perfect chin. Chris found himself staring up at her from the ground in front of the station door, with a jaw that felt dislocated.
"You conceited peacock! Humor me, will you? At least!" she snarled. "You can't accuse me of misusing my gift this time!"
He lifted one hand and felt along his jawline, a little dazed.
"No, that was a physical attack, all right."
But by the time he answered, she had turned on her heel and stalked off toward the tiny lake, into the darkness. By the time he gathered his wits and came after her, there was no sign of her beyond a little pile of clothing next to the blankets they'd spread there earlier in the day. Now he was beginning to become angry. After all, he hadn't meant to insult her, and a little worried as well. He began stripping off his own clothing to go in after her. As he waded in through the shallows, he saw something moving across the lake, coming toward him. Before he had any idea of what she intended, she pulled both his legs out from beneath him and yanked him under the water. Coughing and spluttering, he broke the surface again to see her bobbing just out of reach. She was laughing at him.
"Bitch!"
he yelled, and dove furiously after her. But when he reached the place where she had been, she was gone, and the surface of the pond was undisturbed. He peered around in the dim light, trying to locate her when hands grasping his ankles gave him just enough warning to hold his breath this time. Once again he was pulled under, and once again she escaped, without his laying a finger on her. This time when he surfaced and gasped for air, he did not immediately set out after her. When he didn't move, she called mockingly,
"That's not going to save you, you know,"
and dove under, vanishing. He waited for her to surface, ready to catch her before she'd fully located him. When she didn't, he waited for currents that would tell him she was somewhere nearby, beneath the water. Nothing happened, and he began to be a little concerned. She'd been under an awfully long time. He struck out for the spot he'd last seen her. He had no sooner begun to move when she erupted from the water immediately behind him. Hands on his shoulders drove him under. He kicked free and came thrashing back up to find her a bare finger length out of reach.
"Infatuated fool, am I? Stupid, am I? Then why can't you catch me?"
He kicked off after her, windmilling the surface energetically. She didn't seem to be expending half the effort he was, yet she sped through the water with ease, remaining out of reach with a laziness that galled. From time to time she'd vanish altogether, and this was the signal that he'd better hold his breath because shortly after her disappearance he would find himself pushed or pulled under the surface again. And no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't catch her even then. Finally, he took refuge in the shallows and waited for her to follow. Now he was angry, humiliated and angry, and ready to take her apart. She rose, dripping, out of the water, just out of reach. He glared at her and suddenly realized he'd put himself in a worse position than before. He was stark naked. He could probably pound her into the ground like a tent peg if he could get his hands on her, but if she could get even the tiniest amount of leverage to get a knee in, oh, she could hurt him. Anger, frustration, and acute embarrassment chased each other around inside of him until he was nearly vibrating with conflicting impulses, while she glared back, just as angry as he was. Until something of his inner confusion communicated itself to her, and she collapsed to her knees, laughing helplessly. His anger ran away like water. He was completely exhausted. When anger stopped giving him an energy boost, he felt it. He turned his back on her, climbed out of the water, and dragged himself onto the waiting blanket without bothering to reach for a towel or his clothing. As he lay face down, panting, he heard footsteps behind him. "No more, please," he groaned. "You've won. I've lost. I'm an idiot. And a bore. Truce."
"You give up too easily," Talia laughed, deep in her throat, like a cat purring. "And you deserved what you got. Karen's right. Every so often you start to think you can have everything your own way, and you ought to have a lesson."
She sat down beside him, and he moved his head enough to see that she'd donned her short undershift and was toweling her hair vigorously.
"Where did you ever learn to swim like that?"
"Cheryl," she replied. "Oh, I've been able to swim since I was very little, but my efforts were a lot like yours, loads of thrashing to little purpose. After the time I was dumped in the river, Albrecht detailed Cheryl to teach me the efficient way to swim and how to keep from drowning under most conditions. Next winter she gave me a final exam by pushing me off the bridge, fully clothed. Obviously I passed, though a pair of my boots is still probably residing at the bottom of the river. Good thing I'd almost outgrown them.
Remind me never to anger either of you while swimming."
"Count Karen in on that, too. She's just as good."
"Poor abused Cress."
He could almost see her eyes sparkling with mischief.
"Are you half drowned?"
"Three quarters, and completely worn out."
"Forgive me, but I doubt that."
She ran a delicate finger along his spine. He gritted his teeth and remained unmoving, trying his best to ignore the shivery, pleasant sensations she was causing. When he didn't respond, except for goosebumps, she simply laughed again and began stroking him delicately from neck to knees. He was determined not to yield and held himself as quiet as possible.
"Stubborn, hmm?"
she chuckled. Before he had any notion of what she intended, she began fondling him in such a way that his original intentions went flying off in every direction.
"Witch!"
he said fiercely, and flipped over so quickly that he managed to get her pinned beneath him.
"I thought you were supposed to be worn out."
"I'll show you how worn out I am,"
he muttered, and began tormenting her in return, playing teasingly with every part of her that he could reach. She simply chuckled throatily and returned kind for kind. He held out as long as he physically could, but the conclusion was foregone. It left them both dripping with sweat and drained as well as sated.
"Lord of lights," he said when he was able to speak. "If that's an example of what Roland does to you, I'm glad Tantris isn't a mare. By the time we finish this circuit, I'd be worn to a shadow."
Instead of replying, she sighed, rose, and took the few steps to the water's edge, plunging gracefully back into the pond. When she returned, clean and dripping, she seemed to have regained a more tranquil mood. Chris took a brief dip himself, and by the time he got back, she was dry again, wearing her sleeveless tunic against the cooling breeze. He dried himself off and handed her the bottle Skiff had left with them. She took a long pull at it and gave it back.
So, it's Midsummer's Eve, We never celebrated Midsummer on the Holdens, she said, and I was always at the Collegium during holidays after I was chosen.
Not celebrate Midsummer? Why not?
He asked in surprise.
Because, according to the elders, it has no religious significance and is only a frivolous and lewd excuse for licentiousness. That's a quote, by the way. What do people usually do Midsummer's Eve?
Your elders have a little right on their side.
He couldn't help smiling.
On Midsummer's Eve, at sunset, there are picnics in the woods. People always begin in large groups, but by this time of night, they've usually paired off. The excuse to sleep out tonight is that you need to sleep in the forest in order to find the freshest flowers in the morning. Believe it or not, when morning arrives, people do manage to pick flowers.
For their lady loves. She probably hadn't meant it to sound cynical, but it did.
Chris was too tired to take offense. No, for every female, no matter who. There's no female of any age that lacks a garland or bouquet. Those that have no relatives get them from anyone that can claim the remotest acquaintance with them. No one is left out, old or young. Women who have been or are about to be mothers get baskets of fruit as well. That day there are more picnics in the woods, family picnics this time, with a bit more decorum, and music and tales in the evening. Bards love it. They're sure to leave with their pockets full of coin, their hair full of flowers, and a young lady or gentleman on each arm. It's rather like a birthing day celebration, but on a bigger scale.
Older folk don't celebrate birthing days either, except to deliver a lecture on responsibility, she said tonelessly.
When is your birthing day?
He asked curiously. Midsummer's Eve, tonight, which is no doubt why I'm such a demon child, having had the bad taste to be born on such a licentious night.
So that's why you've been so off-color.
Chris snatched at the excuse to turn her mood around.
You should have told me.
I'm being more than a bit of a bitch, aren't I? I'm sorry. First I get mad and knock you down. Then I make a fool out of you, knowing damn well that I could probably swim rings around you. Then I half-drown you, and I conclude by doing my best to ruin the rest of the evening by being sour. I'm being rotten, and I apologize.
You've put up with my moods often enough. You're entitled to have off times yourself.
Well, I think I've caught up for the next 100 years or so.
I'm sorry I didn't talk to you about you and me before,
he said, as the bottle came and went. I wish you had. You've been leaving me in knots because I was afraid I'd manipulated you into being fixated on me. I couldn't imagine why you'd be making love to me, unless it was because my gift had warped you. I'm not exactly the God's gift to men, and I've been mostly a problem to you on this trip.
Oh, gods.
He was at a complete loss for words for a long time. Finally, he handed her the bottle and caught her hand when she moved to take it.
Talia, you are a completely lovable and lovely person. I care for you because you deserve it, not because your gift manipulated me. Dirk may well be life-bonded to you, and if that's true, I couldn't be happier. It would satisfy one of my dearest wishes, that both of you should find partners who deserve you, and if those partners should be each other, that would make me one of the happiest people in this kingdom.
Eh, she said hesitantly. I don't know quite what to say.
Just don't hit me again. That's one response to being at a loss for words. I'd rather you didn't repeat. Now, what else is bothering you?
I'm tired. I'm tired of having to struggle for what seems to come easily to everyone else. I'm tired of having responsibility for the whole damned kingdom on my back. I'm tired of being alone and fighting my battles alone.
Well,
look, I know it has to be this way, but I don't have to smile and pretend I like it. And last of all, I'm feeling rotten because nobody has ever given me a midsummer garland or a birthday present.
Makes sense.
The bottle was more than half empty. They'd shared it equally, and Chris was beginning to see things through a very delightful haze.
How does it make sense?
She demanded irritably.
Because if you could have what you wanted, you wouldn't be upset, but you can't, so you are.
It seemed like a brilliant deduction to Chris, and he examined the statement with delight. Talia shook her head as she tried to reason it out.
That just doesn't come out right somehow, she complained.
It will, after another drink.
He passed her the bottle.
When the last drop of liquor was gone, so was her ill temper.
"I am very, very glad that we've got something to sleep on right here," Chris said carefully. It's much nicer. You can see the stars, and I can't walk anymore anyway."
"Stars are nice," she agreed. "Not moving's nicer."
"See the Wayne?"
"Who?"
"The Wayne. Those stars just over the big pine there. 5 for the bed and the axle, 2 for the wheels, 3 for the tongue."
"Wait a minute." She peered at the stars, trying to get them to form up properly, and was delighted when she finally did.
"What's the rest of them?"
"Right next to the Wayne's the Hunter. There's the 2 little stars for his belt, 2 more for his shoulders, 4 for his legs."
He realized by her steady breathing that she had fallen asleep. He reached over for the second blanket and covered them both with it, without disturbing his floating head much. He lay back, intending to think a little, but a little thinking was all he managed, since he, too, was soon drowsing. The next morning he woke before she did, and remembered the conversation of the night before. He moved very carefully, hoping that he wouldn't wake her, and, on being successful, moved off into the woods on a private search. Talia woke to an incredibly subtle perfume wreathing around her. She opened sleep-blurred eyes to see where it was coming from, to discover that someone had placed a bouquet by her head.
"What?"
she said sleepily, trying to think why there should be flowers beside her.
"Who?"
"A joyous midsummer to you, herald Talia, and a wonderful birthing day as well," Chris said cheerfully from a point behind her. "It's a pity that more of your friends couldn't deliver trifles, but you'll have to admit that we are a bit far from most of them. I trust you'll accept this one as a token of my profound apology for insulting you last night. I didn't intend to."
"Chris,"
she exclaimed, as she sat up and took up the flowers, breathing the exquisite fragrance with hedonistic delight.
"You didn't need to do this."
"Ah, but I did. It wouldn't be midsummer unless I gathered at least one bouquet. Besides, that scent you're enjoying is supposed to be a sovereign remedy for hangover."
"Is it?" she laughed.
"I have no idea," he admitted. "Part of my hangover always includes a stopped-up nose. Look at the stems, why don't you?"
Holding the bouquet together was a silver ring of a design of 2 hands clasped together. It was the token a herald only gave to the friends he loved best.
"Chris, I don't know what to say."
"Then say, 'Thank you, Chris, and I accept your apology.'"
"Thank you, love, and I do accept your apology, if you'll accept mine."
"I would be only too pleased to," he said, giving her a cheerful grin. "Dear heart, I'd intended to give you that at midwinter, but since you said you'd never had a birthing day gift, the opportunity was too good to pass by, and it had damn well better fit. You wouldn't believe how hard it is to get someone's ring size without them knowing. It goes on the right hand, little bird. The left is reserved for another purpose."
Talia slipped it on, vowing to discover when Chris's birthing day was so as to return the gesture with interest.
"It's perfect," she said, as he sat down next to her with a very pleased expression.
She threw her arms around him, completely happy for the first time in months, and opened a tiny channel of rapport deliberately so that he could know what she couldn't say in words.
"Whew, that's as intoxicating as what we were drinking last night, little bird."
She took the hint and closed the channel down again, but she could tell that he had enjoyed the brief thrill.
"What are these flowers? I've never smelled anything so wonderful in my life. I think I could live on the scent alone."
"A little deep woods northern flower that only blooms at this time of year. It's called Maiden's Hope. I thought you might like it."
"I love it."
She continued to breathe in the scent of the flowers, with her eyes half shut. Chris thought with amusement that she looked rather like a young cat in her first encounter with catmint, and told her so.
"I can't explain it. It smells like sunrise, like a perfect spring day, like the heart's desire.
How about, like, breakfast? He replied comically.
Breakfast? Oh, well, if that's your heart's desire.
She laughed at him and rose smoothly to her feet. It's my turn, so I guess I'd better reward you for being so outrageously nice to me after I tried to murder you last night.
And since you seem so enamored of those flowers, I'll see that you have some in your wedding garland, if I have to nurture them in a hothouse myself.
I thought you had a black thumb. She removed one of the creamy white blossoms and tucked it behind one ear.
For you, little bird, my thumb will turn green. I never break my promises if I can help it, and this one I definitely intend to keep.
Then I'd better keep my promise of breakfast. Where will I get my flowers if I let you wither away of starvation?
They gathered their scattered belongings and returned arm in arm to the way station. Chapter 12. Geese honked overhead, heading south. It had been one of those rare, glorious, golden autumn days, far too lovely a day to spend indoors. So Talia and Chris had been hearing petitions stationed behind a wooden trestle table set out in front of the inn door. Their last petitioner had been a small boy leading a very large plow horse, and he had given them a message. Talia scanned the letter and handed it without comment to Chris. He read it in silence, while the scruffy child who had brought it scuffed his feet uneasily through the pile of golden leaves at his feet. Chris returned the message to her as she braced her arm on the rough wood of the trestle table and leaned her chin on one hand.
"How long ago did all this happen?" she asked the boy. "About 2 days," he said, combing dark hair out of his eyes with his fingers. "Few, though. That's been on years. Wouldn't be so bad this time, set for the poisoned well. That's why Grandfather sent me. Reckons in settling now. Before somebody gets killed."
Talia looked up at the position of the sun and added figures in her head.
"I'm for riding out now," she said finally. "Advice?"
Chris brushed more leaves off the table and glanced back over his shoulder at the inn behind them.
"We don't have any more petitions to be heard, but riding out to a place that isolated is going to take the rest of the afternoon. We'll have to ride half the night to make up the time, and we won't have the chance to reprovision until we get to Knoll's Crossing."
Talia Shields chose that moment to go down. She felt the boy's anxiety with enough force to make her nauseous while she fought them back into place. She couldn't manage more than half strength, could still feel the child fretting after they were up.
"I take it that means you think we should reprovision now and wait until tomorrow morning?"
"More or less."
"Well, I don't agree. Let's wrap things up here and move out."
She could feel his disapproval as they followed behind the child, perched like a toy on the back of an enormous, thick-legged horse that was more used to pulling a plow than being ridden.
"You let the boy manipulate you,"
he said finally, as their mounts and chiras kicked up swirls of leaves.
"I didn't. A poisoned well is a serious business out here. It indicates a situation gone out of control. Are you willing to have deaths on your conscience because we dallied today buying supplies?"
she whispered, but her tone was angry. He shrugged.
"My opinion doesn't matter. You are the one giving the orders."
She seethed. They argued frequently these days. Now and again it was something a bit more violent than an argument. Chris often seemed to take a stand opposing hers just for sheer obstinacy.
"You bastard," she said as the reason occurred to her.
The boy looked back at her, startled. She lowered her voice.
"You are just opposing me to see if I can be manipulated, aren't you?"
He grinned ruefully.
"Sorry, love. It was part of my orders, including manufacturing emotions, since you can sense them. Face it, if anybody is going to be able to warp your decisions, it would be your counselor. But now that you know..."
"You can stop giving me headaches," she replied tartly. "Now let's get down to business."
"You could have used your gift back there,"
he said as they settled at last into their bed. It had taken a long, hard ride through the moonless, frosty night to reach their station once the feud had been settled.
and it had taken a lot of negotiation to get it settled.
I still haven't figured out the ethics of it, she answered slowly.